Good morning. I'm Donna Quinn, and for the next half hour, you'll be listening to Talk of Our Towns. Today, we have an interesting program based on an event which a lot of people are talking about now. Last week, 7 defendants in the Malheur refuge occupation, 41-day occupation this year, were acquitted, were found not guilty. That decision has a lot of reverberations. Today, we're going to be talking about that with our Clatsop County's own district attorney, Josh Marquis. He has been Clatsop County district attorney for 23 years. He was also a special assistant U.S. attorney for 5 years, in addition to a huge bio. And we're going to find out a little bit more about him in just a minute when we welcome you. Thank you so much for being here today, Josh.
Thanks for having me, Donna.
I know you're really busy, and I really appreciate you making the time to be here and talk with us about this Malheur Bundy case, the decision, and help us understand maybe what happened. But a lot of the listening audience may not know about you, so please tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, I've been a lawyer for 36 years. I grew up in Eugene. My father was a professor at the University of Oregon. I lived overseas for a couple years when my father taught. I came back. I went to undergraduate school at the University of Oregon. I graduated from there. I went to the law school at the University of Oregon, graduated from there. I've been working in district attorney's offices for almost 40 years, first in Eugene for 11 years, first as a gopher and then as an investigator and finally a deputy DA. And then I moved to California at one point, became a newspaper reporter and a speechwriter for the California Attorney General. But I missed Oregon terribly. I came back and worked down the coast in Newport for 4 years as a deputy DA and then chief deputy DA, and went into private practice for a couple of years in Eugene doing defense work, which I really didn't like very much. Became the chief deputy district attorney, which is the number two position, in Bend for 4 years. And then in March of 1994, after the previous district attorney was arrested, indicted, convicted, jailed, and disbarred, Governor Roberts appointed me to replace her, and I had to stand for election 2 months after arriving in Astoria as a complete unknown in a contested race. And I was elected and then have been reelected 6 times since.
And you lecture and travel throughout the country. And you write a lot of opinions. In fact, there is a website. It's coastda.com.
Right. It's basically a library of mostly written stuff about subjects that. And by the way, when I travel, I know this may sound a little. I make sure that whenever I travel outside the state of Oregon, the taxpayers of Clatsop County don't pay for it. In other words, if a group like I'm going to, I was in Florida last month. Next month, I'm going to Idaho to speak. If people want me to come speak, they pay for it because it wouldn't be right. So, but one of the things that I find personally fascinating, besides things like victims' rights, drunk driving, is the interrelationship between popular culture and the law, and how people who are not involved in the legal system, what their impressions are of how it does or doesn't work through popular culture, which includes everything from the New York Times to, you know, television shows.
Exactly. And so before we begin discussing the Malheur occupation, for some listeners who maybe have just arrived and aren't familiar with it, Malheur is a refuge in southeast Oregon. It is a spectacular place. I've been fortunate enough to have camped there and spent time there. I don't even know how to describe the people who took it over. It was not really a militia. What would you call
a prosecution of a couple of ranchers named the Hammonds, who were sort of part of this movement of self-styled. They would like to call themselves patriots. They believe the federal government has overextended its reach and shouldn't really own land. And there's a long, complicated relationship between ranchers and the federal government all throughout the West about grazing rights. These two men were convicted, father and son, of starting a fire on BLM land. They were sentenced originally. They were found guilty in a trial, originally sentenced to a relatively brief period of sentence. The federal prosecutor appealed the sentence. They were brought back and resentenced to much longer prison terms. That was the catalyst that set this all off. A group of people not from Oregon, this is really important, people, the Bundy family, who had been staging confrontations with the federal government, mainly in Nevada, announced that they were going to come to tiny little Harney County, which has, I think, 4,000 people in it. It's in extreme southeast Oregon. Harney County is where there's Malheur County, but the Harney County or the Malheur Reserve is not in Malheur County. It's actually in Harney County.
Near the city of Burns, Oregon, or the small town of Burns,
Very
Oregon.
Small town, but it's the county seat. And so in December, essentially, late December of 2015, these people from almost entirely from outside of Oregon decided that they were going to come and try to force somehow the local sheriff and others to rescind this federal judge's order, which was never going to happen. And in the course of this, they ended up arriving with at least several dozen heavily armed men and some women, and ended up taking over the Malheur Field Station of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management.
Thank you. That puts it into context. What's interesting is because when I think it's important to note that the Forest Service land and the Bureau of Land Management land, that is land that all of us own. All Americans own this land.
Well, the concept of federal lands are they're basically held in trust for the people of the United States by various federal agencies. Actually, east of the Cascades, most of the land tends to be BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land, and west of the Cascades, it tends to be U.S. Forest Service land. That just happens because we have a lot more rain on the west side, so you see more forest than you do when you get well into eastern Oregon.
Exactly. And I, having lived on a ranch in Idaho and having and I am familiar with there's this tension. Ranchers want to have, you know, more land. They think the state should manage it. The federal government and a lot of other conservation organizations say no, because then it could be chopped up, parceled off. It's not for sale. That land belongs to all Americans, and it's safer in the hands of the federal government. But then you have these, again, the ranchers who say, no, we want control of the land. However, do you want to just address maybe the Native Americans originally owned the land. In fact, okay, let me just say this, because you and I talked about this. As a brand new this morning on Oregon Live, and there's an opinion, November 2nd. This opinion is written by Kirby Brown. Kirby is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. He's also an assistant professor of Native American literatures in the English department at the University of Oregon. And this morning he said, and I'm just going to read a very brief piece of this, and then we'll talk a little bit about that. Last Thursday, a jury in Portland exonerated seven defendants charged in the 41-day armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Aside from procedural debates over jury nullification or the reality that the defendants were in fact guilty of literally every single charge, what was often lost in the ruckus was the historical fact that the occupation took place on the ancestral lands of the Wadaka people, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, and that the treaty guaranteed lands of the Burns Paiute Nation. The Malheur Reservation, established in 1872, was progressively reduced and eventually dissolved under pressure from settler, industrial, political, and military interests. Of the original 1.4 million acres, only 760 acres remain for the federally recognized Burns Paiute Tribal Nation. In this context, the Bundys weren't just occupying federal lands against an overreaching government. They were occupying federal lands which had been forcibly carved out of indigenous treaty lands to make way for the free range they were laying claim to. They were thus taking up arms against the very legal and political system that made their life possible in the first place on lands that weren't theirs to begin with. And then he compares it with the events taking place across the country at Standing Rock, North Dakota. Do you want to address any of this?
Well, there's a couple big problems with what the professor said. For one thing, he said that the jury exonerated them. Exoneration is a very powerful term. It means that they cleared them of all wrongdoing. And as one of the jurors themselves correctly pointed out when interviewed, these men were and one woman were not exonerated. They were not found innocent. They were simply found not guilty, which means that the jury found that the government had not met the high burden. So I think one language matters, and to say that they've been exonerated. The professor has a point to an extent. Most of the land in the western United States originally belonged to the indigenous people, and the United States government has a dreadful history of violating treaty after treaty after treaty, mostly signed somewhere in the late 19th century. In fact, where we sit right now was probably part of the Clatsop Indian tribe, which were pretty much extinguished by disease brought by white settlers in the early part of the 19th century. I think the last full-blooded Clatsop Indian died in about 1905. So, yeah, I mean, he has a point in the sense that the problem with saying, I mean, to use an analogy, just look at what's been going on for the last 70 years in Israel. You have one group of people, the Israelis, who say, God gave us this land. We have lived here for 2,000 years. We've been forced off it multiple times. It's our land. And you have the Palestinians who say, well, it's our land too. And there's bitter, bitter fighting over it. I'm not sure how much mileage one can get out of the, well, if we go back far enough, my great-grandfather to the 10th degree had better title than you did to it. What concerns me more is something that's chiseled over the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. It's a saying of John Adams that said, we are a nation of laws, not a nation of men. And aside from the sexism of the comment, which considering how influential John Adams' wife was, what really is a whole separate conversation. But it's the idea that the law is not what anybody who holds the gavel, so to speak, at the moment, whether that's the district attorney, the governor, the judge, or even the jurors say it is. Because if you allow people to just say, well, I don't like this law, or I don't like the fact that this treaty was signed, then what you're doing is you're putting the power, you no longer can count on the law being equally exercised. And that is concerning because the idea of protection of the laws needs to extend to everybody. And I don't think it did with the verdict, and we can talk about that. That doesn't mean I'm rejecting the verdict. I'm a lawyer. I believe in our system, and I believe that we have to respect juries' verdicts.
Right, and I want to apologize. They're doing some leaf blowing out here, so if you hear any background noise, that's what's happening, and hopefully they'll be finished very soon. Josh, there people are, and I like this idea that you're talking about the law, the perception, and also modern social culture, and that is that there is a perception now in the news. A lot of people are saying this is the verdict is ridiculous. It's going to it signals to these white militia members that trespassing on government property and trashing publicly owned facilities and equipment is an action that can be beat. There are a lot of people who are very worried.
Well, it's more than just beat. It's the concern is that that many of these people, certainly the people that were directly involved and many of their supporters, have taken this verdict not merely as an individual judgment as to whether or not they were guilty or not guilty of conspiracy, which was really the only decision the jury had to make, but that this is essentially an endorsement of their conduct. And one of the most alarming things is what the head of this group, Ayman Bundy, has said. He's still in federal custody, by the way, that they intend to go forward and do more of this, and which means, in theory, that they're going to go forward carrying, AR-15s and assault weapons and confront more and more people in presumably isolated environmental stations and whatnot. And there have been some really tragic examples in recent American history of what happens when groups holding extremist views decide that they are going to confront the power of the federal government. And people talk about Waco and Ruby Ridge, in both cases in which people with outlier beliefs confronted different federal agencies, both of which started, although people tend to forget this, with the murder of federal agents. And people never remember their names. It was a U.S. Marshal named Thomas Deegan who was gunned down in rural Idaho, and that in turn led to an escalation and the killing of Randy Weaver's wife and a whole bunch of other things.
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about what the federal government tried to prove, and then what happened with the jury, and about how you feel like juries typically do a very good job. But if you just tuned in, you're listening to Talk of Our Towns. I'm your host, Donna Quinn. Today, I have in the studio Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis. He and I are having a discussion about the decision last week by a Portland jury to find 7 defendants of the 41-day occupation of the Malheur Refuge not guilty. Josh, you said that in most cases you think juries do a good job.
I think, I've probably tried over 300 jury trials in my career. in my 35 years as a lawyer. And I don't win all of them, by the way. But I think about 85 to 90% of the time juries get it right. And sometimes that means the state didn't prove its case, and in which case the right verdict is a not guilty verdict. Now, I've been a prosecutor more, so obviously I'm disappointed when a verdict that I'm asking for. But that being said, one has to respect what America has is a unique intersection of democracy and justice. Almost every other nation on earth, including most Western European countries, have professional judges, or they sometimes call them assessors, who sit in judgment. The idea of pulling 12 people out of the community and having them judge is a uniquely sort of American idea, which is that the wisdom lies in the public rather than in the elites. And so I think there's something inherently really good in that. And again, that doesn't always mean you get the result you want, but you have to respect that. And you can't just say, okay, I like that verdict, therefore the jury system is good, and I don't like that verdict, therefore the jury system is bad. There are outlier verdicts. The ones that come to mind, at least for me, the O.J. Simpson verdict struck me as a tremendous injustice. I think it did terrible damage to race relations in America. More along the lines of this case, there was a case that some of your listeners may recall, a man named Claude Dallas, a self-styled mountain man, murdered two Idaho Fish and Game officers in 1982 in rural Idaho, and convinced a jury that basically they were about to draw down on him. And although there was an eyewitness to him executing these two men, he was found guilty only of involuntary manslaughter. The judge gave him a 30-year sentence. He escaped from prison in Idaho, fled to California, and was eventually found not guilty by an Idaho jury, who then decided that he was, his claim that the government was gunning for him. That case is still, he only got out of prison about 6 or 7 years ago. But that verdicts like that, sometimes, and the O.J. Simpson verdict make people say, well, I'm not sure the jury system is such a good idea, and maybe would I have something else doing it. I don't think you can throw out the jury system for that. And I wasn't in the courtroom, so I don't know, other than reading the newspaper like everybody else, what the government's evidence was. And, it sounds like I'd say 95% of the time, jurors really do try to do their very best. But keep in mind that there's things that they're not allowed to hear. And we just had a verdict here on my office tried a murder case, and one of the jurors came to watch the sentencing of a co-defendant and was astonished to hear some of the facts that the trial jury had not been allowed to hear. And it wasn't that anybody was keeping it from them. It's just that some things are not admissible in the trial.
And I know that you've read what some of the jurors have said.
Yes.
And some of them have said that given the proving that it was a conspiracy, which is much trickier than a lesser charge of trespassing, which they obviously were guilty of. I mean, everyone saw the footage on television of the weapons, and everybody knew.
Well, but keep in mind that the argument of the Bundys and their lawyers was they were guilty of nothing. Their version was that they were simply engaging in a peaceful protest, that they never specifically ran off any federal employees, that they never actually said, I'm going to shoot you, and that they only brought the weapons to defend themselves against somebody else who might do violence to them. Now, I mean, I believe any of that. And although trespassing, which are lesser charges, might have been more easily proved, frankly, those charges are so minor, I'm not sure if the federal government would have felt it was almost worth it to prosecute them for it. Conspiracy is touchier. You have to prove an agreement between two or more people to engage in a criminal enterprise, even if that enterprise is something as simple as let's go take over a building with guns and make sure that everybody else leaves. I mean, most of us look at the verdict or that case, and we see that they Tort put up signs that said closed permanently on the Malheur National Refuge, and then renamed the places, or that they went through and, in the view of some archivists, defaced Indian artifacts and went through files as clear evidence that what they were doing was illegal. Unfortunately, I think the verdict will send a message to a group that call themselves patriots or three percenters or all kinds of other things, which are really a tiny, tiny percentage of certainly Oregonians and even people in the country. But they are people that have a, to say the least, conspiratorial view that the federal government is out to get them, maybe in the pay of some sort of international banking organization, and that they are really part of the second American Revolution. And that's really spooky for me. As somebody in law enforcement, we encounter people like this occasionally. I mean, who will, for example, refuse to acknowledge a judge or my authority because the American flag in my office has yellow fringes on it? I'm not making this up. They believe that the yellow fringes make it a maritime flag, and unless I'm actually at sea, which I don't think I am, that I don't have any authority.
And a lot of it also is religious beliefs.
It's tied into that, certainly. I mean, and it runs both directions. For example, the Dakota people who are objecting to this pipeline that is apparently set to run underneath the Missouri River, which provides the water for many of the Dakota, Nakota, Lakota tribes who are protesting it, believe in their, frankly, even older religious beliefs, that this is an affront to their most basic beliefs. And the patriots believe that, you know, God has spoken directly to them. It's one of the reasons I agree with the founders of the American Constitution to try to separate religion and law, because when people start saying, God gave me specific permission to do this, you're going to run into a lot of trouble.
Indeed. You mentioned something I think that's really important. I want to go back to on the jurors. You said that typically jurors are made up of a certain group of folks.
Well, as a practical matter, anyone can be – there's almost no way to get out of jury service. One of the most common questions I get asked by citizens on the street and they find out what I do, it's like, how can I stay out of jury duty? I'm not going to register to vote. That won't do you any good, because they use databases made up of everything from utility bills to and the goal is to try to get a genuinely diverse jury pool. That being said, when people are asked to serve as jurors, a number of classes almost always get out of it. Professionals, doctors, lawyers, for reasons that seem pretty obvious. Small business people, single moms, people whose finances are such that the pittance that the state of Oregon pays for people to be jurors, which really should be probably raised in the federal jury system. I was a juror for one day. I got $310 reimbursement. In the state system, I'd be lucky to get 20. So what happens is that jurors tend to be made up of people who are retired, people who work for the government or large companies, like whatever James Rivers is called these days, the big paper plant out on the Columbia-Clatsop County line, because those companies have contracts that require the company to pay for their employees while they're on jury duty. But what that means is you sort of lose a lot of the true cross-section of the community. So one of the questions you and I were talking about before is, what can people do? And people can always write letters to the editor and express that they're unhappy about this. But really what they can do is, if they're summoned for jury duty, unless it's really going to, financially destroy them, which it can for some people, sign up, agree to do it, because, we are you, or I'm trying to remember that Pogo, I think it was we have met the enemy and he is us, but the friends are us too.
Mm-hmm. It's true. So, Josh, people are making comparisons now between the peaceful demonstration in North Dakota by the Native American indigenous tribes and the armed takeover of Malheur. So we just have a few minutes left. So what do you feel people can learn from the situation?
Well, civil disobedience, which is exemplified by people like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, were based on the principle that if you defied a law that was either unfair in its nature or unfair in its application, that by making yourself available for arrest and accepting at least some of the consequences, you showed the rest of the world or the country how wrong it was. That seems to have been forgotten by many people in the last 20 years who want to engage in civil disobedience, but then they don't want to get arrested. The whole point of civil disobedience is getting arrested and not fighting the police by, you know, throwing, you know, bleach in their face. Usually the cops, are simply following the law as it's currently written. Sometimes laws are wrong. I mean, certainly laws that prohibited black people and white people from marrying, miscegenation laws, which existed up until the 70s in the United States, were wrong. But the thing that I think is really important is what a protest needs to remain civil. And I don't think you can have civil protests if people arm themselves, frankly. The risk is simply too great.
The Oregonian has their opinion last week was that that this was a terrible, you know, obviously decision, and that it was going to unfortunately create a lot more of these kinds of armed takeovers on, you know. And what do you think we can do about that?
Well, as a law enforcement person, I would hope that the government would move swiftly and try as peaceably as possible, but firmly, because with people that are this extreme, if you give them too much rope, they will take it, and people will get hurt. That being said, you know, the First Amendment right to peaceably, you know, protest has to be maintained. You know, again, I really do believe, not just because I'm a lawyer or I'm the district attorney, that the rule of law is important. I would hope there would be a small group that will try to take this. On the most personal level, on the local level, if somebody were to do this at Fort Clatsop, what I would hope that we would do and our federal partners would do would immediately respond as strongly and with as little force as possible, but simply not permit it. To be blunt, from a tactical standpoint, this went on way too long. This was allowed to fester for tactical reasons that I think I understand. But the jury verdict sent a message which simply said they were not guilty, but many of their followers will take it as an endorsement.
Right. And the verdict of not guilty does not mean that they are innocent.
It means the government failed to prove its case.
Exactly. So any last thing you'd like the listening audience to know about this? Or
no, I just think the one thing, you know, people are often interested in the justice system, or they are when they hear about something. Come down to the Clatsop County Courthouse. Watch a trial. We have at least, I don't know, 3-4 criminal trials a month. Some people are intimidated and think, well, you know, am I allowed to go in? That's what all those seats are there for. Unless you're a witness, you're not excluded from a trial. A part of the United States Constitution is that a person is entitled to a public trial, and that right doesn't just belong to the defendant. It belongs to the community.
And one last quick question, Josh. Why weren't we allowed to hear the – I mean, why – you can hear certain state trials, but why couldn't we hear this one?
The federal government, federal courts have a strong aversion and have never allowed audio or video recording of trials. State courts generally have. I think that's too bad. I think people, when they see what happens, they generally have more confidence in it.
Okay, good. Josh, thank you so much for being here. I know you're a thoughtful person. You, if you want to read some of Josh's opinions and ideas and thoughts about things, you can go to coastda.com. And again, I appreciate you making time to come and talk with us about this very current topic that lots of opinions are going to be flying around now about, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you. Terry Wilson, our engineer extraordinaire, really appreciate you being here today, as usual. And also my gratitude to local talented banjo instructor Michael Bruin for his original theme music for this program. Get involved. Go see a trial. Josh, thank you for that. And learn more about what's happening in your community and how the law works here. And until next week, find a moment for yourself today to take a deep breath. It's good for your body, it's good for your mind and for your spirit, and then focus on all the things that are going well in your life. There will always be those things that aren't going well. You can turn on the news and that can unfortunately make you not feel very good for a little while, but focus on the things in your world which are going well with gratitude, and then give yourself a loving and compassionate hug or a pat on the back for being uniquely you, for doing the best you can, and for being here now in this moment, the only moment which exists, the now moment, on the amazing planet we call Earth.
You've been listening to Talk of Our Towns with your host,